Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're on Twitter at KUOW, and we are going to begin today in Olympia, where we're learning more about sexual harassment in our state government.
This is, you know, an institution that always has issues, but there were no issues that forced Representative Jacks to resign. There were issues that he was dealing with that led to his decision.
That's House Majority Leader Pat Sullivan speaking 6 years ago after Democratic State Representative Jim Jacks of Vancouver abruptly resigned his seat for what Sullivan said were personal and family reasons. Yesterday, Sullivan said there was more to the story. He released a statement that mentioned an after-hours get-together at a bar on St. Patrick's Day 2011. That statement reads, in part, quote, "Representative Jim Jacks' behavior at that gathering prompted patrons at the bar to complain to another member." The statement goes on to say, quote, "A female staffer also alleged that Jacks had acted inappropriately towards her." KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins is back with us. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Bill.
Who is the state lawmaker Jim Jacks?
Well, at the time, he was a 41-year-old, married, father of two. He was serving the beginning of his second term in the state House of Representatives. He represented Vancouver, Washington. Previously, he had been Governor Chris Gregoire's Southwest Washington public liaison officer.
And what are the allegations against him?
Well, we really don't know beyond that statement that you just read. At this point, House Majority Leader Pat Sullivan is either unwilling or doesn't know enough of the details to go on the record about what happened. This was a scene, as you described, at a bar on St. Patrick's Day in the evening. The behavior that was observed concerned two patrons enough that they went to another lawmaker, as the statement says, in the bar and said, hey, you know, whatever this guy is doing is not acceptable. And then it appears that that female staffer, who we believe was also at the bar, at some point also alleged inappropriate behavior, very likely to that same lawmaker. And whatever that was, it was serious enough to trigger a sequence of events that unfolded very quickly and led within the next 5 to 7 days to him resigning.
And this staffer, this woman, did not file a formal complaint. She wanted to remain anonymous. If there was no formal complaint, why did Jacks resign?
So, as I was explaining, after that night, the information gets passed along, we believe, from the lawmaker who was there that night, the other lawmaker, to leadership and to the House Chief Clerk's office. As we understand it, they then met with Jacks, who denied the allegations, flatly denied them, but then later told his leadership team that he had an alcohol problem while, quote, continuing to minimize the extent and effect of any inappropriate behavior that may have occurred. At that point, the House Clerk's office and leadership were considering sanctioning him, taking away his committee assignments, restricting his access to staff. However, they ultimately came to the conclusion that his behavior was, quote, serious enough to warrant his resignation. And at that point, even though the alleged victim didn't want to formally complain, they decided the behavior was serious enough that they should ask him to resign his seat.
By the way, do you have to go public in order to file a formal complaint? Do you have to publicize your name to complain formally?
Well, technically, it's not going to be broadcast or made public, but what the House Policy and Procedures Manual clearly says is that while investigations will be handled in a confidential manner to the extent possible, the reality is if you file a formal complaint against someone, that person is going to find out who you are. The way the process works is the identity of the person who's complaining will be shared with the person who's being accused of doing something improper.
I see. And where is this former lawmaker, Jim Jacks? Where is he today?
As far as we can tell, he is, according to his LinkedIn profile and according to the website for his apparently current employer, he is with an organization called Oregon Solutions that's affiliated with Portland State University. He's a project manager there, so it appears he's working at least in conjunction with the higher ed environment.
And have you talked to him about his resignation?
I have called him. I called him last night. He immediately hung up on me. I called him back and left a message. I have not heard back, and I did send an email and call him again today at work and still have not heard from him.
So the House Majority Leader, Pat Sullivan, who we heard at the beginning of this, being very general, saying there were no issues that forced Representative Jacks to resign, Now he's talking more. Why is he talking to us about this now?
So as you know, we reported earlier this week with the Olympian and the News Tribune on the workplace culture at the state capitol. We interviewed 9 women who work in and around the capitol, lobbyists, staffers, a former lawmaker, who all described unwanted attention, unwanted touching, and even incidents that involved grabbing buttocks, grabbing breasts. In the wake of that reporting, we requested more information about former state representative Jim Jacks. At the same time, or sometime previous, the Associated Press also requested information about Jim Jacks. We have put public records requests into the state legislature asking for more information. Those requests have been denied, and in fact, we are part of a lawsuit challenging those denials at present. But based on new requests for information, and also based on all of the reporting about sexual harassment and misbehavior in this state house and capitals across the country, the House Democratic leadership decided to release some more information. Senator or Representative Pat Sullivan said the goal is to let people know that when allegations come to their attention, action is taken. I will tell you that I've talked to a lot of women who do not feel that that is always the case, or that this process favors them, or even very often works in their favor.
And have you heard about new allegations about sitting lawmakers, current lawmakers, since you reported this story?
What we've been told is that some of the women who work in and around this environment keep an informal list. It's a short list, they say, of 4, 5, 6, perhaps, current lawmakers and lobbyists who they advise young women, interns, new lobbyists to avoid or to not meet with alone. In terms of specific allegations of sexual harassment or sexual assault against anybody currently sitting in the legislature, we have not, to this point, heard a story that would at least merit reporting yet.
Yeah, merit reporting. What are your basic criteria when you decide when you would report a legislator's name?
I think everybody agrees these are tough situations all around. Oftentimes, there are no witnesses to the behavior. The women very often feel that the power differential in the state house in particular is such that they cannot afford to speak publicly, because if they're a lobbyist, they need these lawmakers to meet with them and to vote for their bills. If they are staffers, they are working for these individuals. And in that sense, there's a huge reluctance to come forward and to speak in general, but especially about anybody currently sitting in office. That said, something's clearly changed in the last week here in Olympia, and in the last month, I would say, here in this country. And it is also true that women more and more seem comfortable speaking out and are doing so and are calling us, and we always welcome more calls. We're available. We're here. We want to tell these stories. We want to report accurately about what's happening here, and we want to help or shed some light on what really goes on behind the scenes in your state capitol.
So finally, Austin, we've been telling you about some of the facts of these and allegations. The State House is reviewing its policies and procedures, and there's a final report, I understand, coming up soon. What could change officially in terms of harassment or sexual abuse policies and procedures? What could change because of this? Do we know?
Well, we should point out that the House began this review back in January. The Senate has its own rules and its own policies, and we're not aware of a similar review in the state Senate. The final report is due out in the coming weeks, and then House leadership will create a work group made up of staff and members to try to figure out how to implement these recommendations. The recommendations apparently are going to be coming from an outside law firm. When I have talked with women who work here about what process they would feel comfortable with, keep in mind, a lot of the women are telling stories about things that happened to them when they were very young and new to Olympia, and they didn't understand the dynamic, and they felt they had so much to lose. So getting somebody in that situation to a place where they're comfortable reporting under any circumstance is very difficult. But one idea we've heard from the women, not from the institution, is there needs to be an independent outside place to go, because the reality is under the dome is political. Under the dome, everybody's working for a politician or an elected official. Under the dome, they're concerned about the institution or the member or their party majority. That's the feeling. And that they need a safe place to go that is separate and apart from the institution.
Well, we'll see whether that recommendation and other ideas come to fruition. Your reporter under the dome in Olympia is our correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Austin, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And as Austin said, you heard him. He'd like to hear from anybody who has a story to tell. So you can, as always, talk to us at KUOW. You could email us, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. You can give us a call at 206-543-5869. We'll be back with more of The Record in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now we're going to answer one of your questions.
My name is Mary Wisner. I wonder, what happens to the recycling after I put it in the bin? Thanks.
Thanks for wondering and for asking us, Mary. Here's one answer in the form of the sound effect. Yeah, that's a sound of an optical sorter using pressurized air to separate plastics at Recology Cleanscapes. It's a recycling sorting center in King County. But to truly answer Mary's question, what happens to my recycling waste, we're going to have to go to China. We're going to have to climb inside a dirty peanut butter jar. Let's begin with China. The Chinese government is reorganizing its whole recycling system, which is going to affect you and me here in Washington State. We're going to take your calls. So I'm going to give out the phone number first. Your recycling questions, just like Mary's, maybe more detailed. What do you want to know about how your recycling works? Give us a call right now, 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. Okay, now to tell you about China, we have Elijah Wolfson, who is science editor of the news site Quartz. Elijah, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
So recycling is not something our government runs. It is a market. Could you just, in a nutshell, let us know how the recycling market works?
Sure. So municipalities decide what to do with their solid waste, and some of them invest in local reclamation facilities so that the stuff gets recycled nearby. And but in many cases, it is also shipped out to other countries that have higher capacity for recycling or higher need for raw materials than, say, Washington State might. So, it is a market. People are willing to pay for this stuff to some extent. It's not highly valuable, but in bulk it can be.
And a lot of that material goes to China. Two-thirds of the world's recyclables, I've heard. And as I said, China's about to stop taking some of our recyclables. Why are they doing that?
Yeah, so China imports something in the range of, $18 billion a year worth of recyclables annually. They are currently, so in June, they issued new regulation that would restrict a number of categories of recyclables that were traditionally, that have been imported there for the last couple of decades. There's a number of reasons for it. It's sort of complex. There's no single cause, but among other things, the way you can think about it is that in the past, or in the recent past at least, China and a lot of other developing countries have been the source of production of a lot of plastics and paper packaging and that sort of thing that gets sent over to North America and Western Europe, and then we throw it out and send it back to them.
Mm-hmm.
But as China has, as China's economy has improved and the middle class has grown, they're a market themselves for this stuff, and so they don't really need our secondhand materials anymore.
And what are they not taking anymore? One thing I heard is that they're not taking dirty, contaminated waste.
Well, yeah.
Even food waste.
Actually. They launched a program back in something like 2013, I believe, where they, it didn't change the actual sort of rules around what could come into the country, but what it did do is it gave regulators more power to manage and reduce the contamination of the recyclable materials that were being imported into China. The initiative was called the Green Fence, And it did actually dramatically decrease the overall number of waste imports that China had. But recently, the regulations that we're talking about right now are more specific. It is specifically to ban 24 varieties of solid waste. It includes most recyclable plastics, so I'm sure your listeners have heard of PET and PVC. It also includes things like paper and textiles and a number of other things. So it's a pretty pretty broad ban, actually.
And bottom line, what does this mean for our listeners? What are they going to do, or should they be doing differently because China is not taking what it used to?
Well, I don't know if the average the average person really can do much about this. I mean, ultimately, it's going to be up to Washington State to figure out what it wants to do with this. In the past 15 years, as China has emerged as a destination for some of these recyclables, many states, including Washington, have really decreased their capacity to manage recyclables and solid waste. So, for example, in the last 15 years, Washington has only opened one new landfill, and it's closed seven. I think that what's going to have to happen is that the state and other states, especially on the West Coast, California as well, which is where I'm based, are going to have to adjust and either figure out invest in capacity to recycle and reclaim waste materials, or invest in technology that improves the overall ability to do this at scale. So I think we'll see. But for the average person, I mean, I don't think there's anything you could really do to change things.
Okay, so maybe our technology will improve. Maybe some American recycling plants will pop up if China's not taking what they used to. Elijah Wolfson, science editor at Quartz, thanks a lot for this.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there are already a lot of recycling processed in Seattle. We've got Kevin Kelly here with us, the general manager of Recology Cleanscapes in the Industrial District. The Industrial District, where is that?
We're down in the Georgetown area.
Oh, okay, got it. And we've got you here. Thanks for coming, by the way.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
To explain the ins and outs of recycling and to answer your question. So again, I want to give out the phone number, 206-543-5869, 206-543-5869. Seattle recycles how much of its waste, roughly?
It's about 60%. So that means of all the material that's being collected, 60% is staying away from landfills. Now, that's a combination of both recycling, traditional recycling, and composting. So that's the yard waste, the food scraps, the things that are going into the green bin. So that's a very high number and something that Seattle and its residents should be proud of.
I heard that China doesn't want to take food contaminated recyclables. Have you heard that?
We have. And that's been true for a long time. That's not necessarily a new issue. The issues with food contaminants is that it ruins the fibers in the paper, so it makes it weaker and more reduces the quality of the material that we're recycling.
Okay, because I was picturing my peanut butter jar or my plastic orange juice jug. It's all being incinerated. What does it matter whether it's got a little drippings in it?
Well, it's not being incinerated.
Oh, let's start there.
But it is, once it leaves a facility like ours in South Seattle, what we do is we sort all of the material out because you put several different types of material in one bin. And our job at our facility in Seattle is to sort all of that out by material type and make sure that it's sent off to the end user, whoever that may be, whether it's China or somebody else, in a condition where they can actually recycle and reuse that material.
Okay, so even in that sorting plant, food messes up the papers.
It does. It affects the ability to process it and ultimately end up with a high quality material, which is ultimately.
So I got to wash out my peanut butter jar?
What we say is if you have enough peanut butter left in there to make one peanut butter and jelly sandwich, that's too much.
Okay, I don't leave that much. I'm too stingy for that.
That's great. That's what we're looking for.
Oh,
the cleaner the better. Clean and dry is what we're looking for.
Okay. All right. So why dry? Why dry?
Well, dry makes it, it makes it easier to process because of the equipment that we're dealing with. But it also, again, with fiber material specifically, it has an impact on the quality of the material that ultimately gets recycled.
I don't have a separate drying rack for stuff that I'm recycling and throwing into my bin. You know that, right?
I do. I appreciate that. And from time to time here in Seattle, we do get that rainy stuff coming from the sky.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we understand that it's not always perfect, but to the extent that people understand the importance of the clean and dry, and if they take even, you know, small steps, they can have a big impact, because this is all about large quantity and large volume. So every step of the way, if people are making a difference, it helps.
Becky on Facebook says, I just discovered there's no longer anywhere in Washington State that recycles car seats. True?
We are having issues with car seats, in part because of how they have to be disassembled. So there was actually a vendor locally who was doing that, who has since stopped. So we are looking.
That seems like a ton of solid. There's got to be a bunch of energy in that heavy plastic in my old car seat.
There is, and there are restrictions around what you can do with a car seat in terms of if the seat has been in an accident and it expires after a certain point in time.
Thus, all the people wanting to recycle them.
That's right, and so there is valuable material there with the fabric and the plastic. But the requirements to disassemble all that has made it difficult.
We're taking your calls, 206-543-5869, your recycling questions. Maybe we can settle a bitter family argument for you. What about bottle caps? I've heard that you have to unscrew those, and I heard that you don't.
Sure. So what we say and what we would encourage you to do is check in your local community to make sure that you're doing it the right way. And there's great resources with both King County and the City of Seattle to confirm these things. What we say for bottle caps is that we would like them left on the bottle, because what happens is it's still plastic and it's still recyclable. It's just a different type of plastic from the PET in the bottle. And when it's sent to the end user, they separate those plastics in water, they scoop the bottle cap material off the top, they get the PET off the bottom, and you're recovering all of that resource.
It's an amazing sounding machine. What about, so many of us get deliverables, Amazon and otherwise, these cardboard boxes. I break down everything and I pull off the tape, because it doesn't seem like the tape should go in the same place shouldn't be attached and sticky attached to the very recyclable cardboard. Is that right? What should I do?
You know, that's great if you do that. And if you do, we want to encourage you to continue doing that. You don't have to.
You have $5 on you? You can just give it to me, because that would be a small price to pay for all the time I've gone through. Okay, go on.
But no, in any case, it is the tape will be handled as the product is recycled throughout that process. So
you could leave
the
you don't have to do that.
You
That's going to save me some time. Yeah. I owe you $5.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Kevin Kelly's GM of Recology Cleanscapes in the Industrial District. And Becca says, shouldn't we in America be able to find ways to use our refuse without shipping it across the world? Is this just the naive wish of an uninformed greenie?
No, it's not. In fact, I think that really what we want to strive—
Becca's on Facebook, by the way.
Oh,
yes.
Hi, Becca on Facebook. What we want to encourage people to do is think about the resources and the materials they're using in the first place. Because if you're using things that are durable, that are long-lasting, you don't have to— if you're not generating waste or recyclable material in the first place, you don't have to worry about managing it.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent you can think about the types of things that you use and that you can reuse, and there are resources out there where you can do that. We have retail stores that offer products where you can have durable, long-lasting materials for your house.
Should we tweet out a link to a resource? Our listeners might want to know more information.
Absolutely.
Okay, so join us on Twitter at KUOW. We have a phone call for you from Siobhan in Gig Harbor. Welcome. What's your question?
Hi. I would like to know why I can't recycle glass here in Gig Harbor.
So that would be a question particular to your community, and I would encourage you to look on your local county or city's website.
Well, what's the theory? What's the glass problem?
One of the things I would say about glass is because of the way it's picked up in the trucks, what happens to it is that it's broken up into many pieces. And as it becomes glass shards and pieces of glass, it causes a lot of damage to the equipment that processes it. And so there are some places that do not like to see glass in their recycling streams, or what they'll do is they'll separate it out entirely. Because glass is recyclable and it's a reusable resource, it can cause damage to the equipment that sorts all the other material out.
What about plastic bags? It's plastic, so it's recyclable, right?
It is. The issue with plastic bags, and what we tell our customers to do, is to bag the bags. And what we mean by that is take one plastic bag that you get at a grocery store, for instance, and stuff all your other bags in there and create one big ball and tie it up. The reason we ask customers to do that is because it can be pulled off by a person at this recycling facility before it wraps around our equipment. Because what will happen is if enough of those plastic bags get into that equipment, it will tie it up and ultimately shut us down for a period of time. And you have to have a person go in and cut these bags out. So the material is recyclable, but if not handled correctly, it can cause a lot of damage to the system.
What about labels on bottles and jars? Should I be pulling those off as I do?
Same thing with the tape on the Amazon boxes.
I am overzealous.
Yeah, so now do you owe me $10?
Yes, I do. Right. It's just really mounting. What are you a fanatic recycler? Like, what in your personal life?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I see the value of it every single day because I see the types of things that people discard on a daily basis, and I see it in great volume. And so it gives me an appreciation to make sure that we're treating our resources with care. You know, I'm a runner. I have running shoes made from ocean plastic.
Cool.
It's the topic of family dinners.
Oh.
So yeah, I'm into
it. I like recycling. I would hang out with you. It wouldn't bore me or guilt trip me.
Well, you keep laying these $5 bills
true,
on me. And,
true, true. Here's a call from Jasmine in LeConnor. Jasmine, I've asked this one myself. What's your question, please?
Hi, I'd like to know why you can't recycle styrofoam.
Yeah.
You can recycle styrofoam.
Huh?
Yeah.
I haven't been doing that.
Now, not in your curbside bin. What you can do is you can take that to different locations. Again, I'll say that Recology has four recycling stores where you can drop off hard to dispose of items like recycling. There is actually a company in Kent called Styrocycle, and they take all the styrofoam, they densify it, and it gets turned into things like picture frames, eyeglasses, or the eyeglass frames, all sorts of things. So styrofoam can be recycled. It is just a question of getting it to the appropriate place.
Okay, so I could have been recycling it, and I didn't. Now I owe you $15. This is Kevin Kelly, GM of Recology Cleanscapes in the Industrial District. That's our time now. Will you come back again?
Absolutely.
I bet there's going to be more questions.
Pleasure.
A final thought from Joshua on Facebook says, recycling was never intended as a panacea for overconsumption. Emphasis should be on reduction, followed by reuse, then recycling, hence the catchphrase, reduce, reuse, recycle. Sounds like you agree.
And that's absolutely right.
Okay.
If you don't generate it, you don't have to manage it.
Well put. Kevin Kelly from Recology Cleanscapes. Great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW. Back in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Did you use GPS for a quicker route to work today or to find a Halloween party on Tuesday night? You were using artificial intelligence. If you use the Amazon Echo to order groceries, that's artificial intelligence. That kind of AI probably doesn't sound scary or malevolent to you, unless you are Tesla's Elon Musk.
We are summoning the demon. You know all those stories where there's the guy with the pentagram and the holy water, and he's like, yeah, you sure you can control the demon? Didn't work out.
Wow, Elon Musk. He's seeing a demon in artificial intelligence. My next guest, more optimistic than that. Dr. Christoph Koch is chief scientist at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. He says humans have ways that we can keep up with artificial intelligence. And one way is to make our brains more flexible.
So the best way right now we know how to do that is education. We know education pays off, particularly education when you're young, when you're very flexible, when you can rapidly learn and assimilate new knowledge, new words, and new skills, enables you to be confront a world that's sort of changing very dynamically. However, is there ways to enhance that? For example, if we take older people who in general have more difficult time to cope with quickly changing situations, can we give them back the plasticity they had as a child? If you remember, as a child, as a 3, 4, 5, and 6-year-old, you could soak up new knowledge, new words, new skill without even trying. You just did them and, you knew how to do them. Well, so that's brain plasticity. Brain plasticity is very high early on as a child, but then it goes down. Is there, for example, a way to artificially enhance that, to control that using pharmacology, using direct brain stimulation? Are we?
What's your answer? Do you think we can plastic?
Well, in principle, there's no reason. We're beginning to understand the brain mechanisms that underlie this so-called neuroplasticity. So in principle, we should be able to understand enough that we can manipulate it, that we can understand exactly what groups of neurons we have to manipulate, how, using drugs or using electrodes or using some sort of external, electrical device in order to control plasticity. That now I do want a lot of plasticity because I need to rapidly learn this new skill. But not all the time, because it may be energetically very costly, or if you have this high plasticity, you may also forget things very quickly. So there's probably going to be trade-off there, but I want us to be able to control them deliberately and delicately and reversibly and safely, and there's no reason we shouldn't be able to do that in the fullness of time.
Can you give me an example of a situation where we will want to and maybe be able to, late in life, have the plasticity of a child, and we want that.
Well, so let's say we're just talking about the 3.5 million truck drivers, and that maybe in 20 years from now, most of them will be redundant because autonomous cars can do the same thing cheaper, much more safely. So let's say you take somebody who's 50 years old who's only driven cars. So you want to. And he wants to be retrained to compete in this new economy. This requires, for example, skill dealing with computers. If he's never dealt with computers directly by programming them, that skill doesn't come easily. Well, so let's say we give him some sort of drug treatment or some sort of treatment that enables him for the next 3 months or 6 months to return his brain to the plasticity he had as a young boy when he could learn things like languages and new things that people showed him, just showed him once or twice, right? So now he retrains. His brain is very flexible. It soaks up new knowledge. He acquires new skills, and then he can go forth in the in the world with these new skills.
And do you get concerned about either the unintended side effects or just the ethics, almost the philosophy of changing our brains with drugs in that way?
You do it every time you drink a cappuccino. No, I'm serious.
Thank
if you
goodness.
Drink a cappuccino, that's active neurochemistry. Why are we drinking it? Because it gives us an arousal. It gives our brain specifically arousal. When you drink alcohol, again, it has very specific effects on the brain, right? So we're doing this all the time. This is just sort of more deliberate, more efficient using newer technologies. Yes, of course, we have to discuss the pros and cons. There will, of course, be downside. So as I said, one obvious downside is when you rapidly learn things, you also rapidly forget things. So it may be, for example, one downside is, yes, I can now acquire this new knowledge, but other things I also forget very quickly. But, if I have to retrain my brain because I lost the job and there isn't a job available in my old profession, then maybe I'm willing to do it. There's also the downside, is this treatment going to be not only safe and reliable, but also available relatively inexpensive to everybody? Or does this just encourage, once again, is this going to increase the gap between the haves and the haves not, right? All these sort of cognitive enhancement therapies. Early on, like always in medicine, they'll be probably very expensive and very experimentally. But then as we develop them and as they sort of seep into the general population, they'll become safer, more efficient, and cheaper. It happened with all sorts of other technology. Look at LASIK technology, right? right? To remove using a laser. I mean, who would have thought 30 years ago that people now, most sort of teenager or young men and women, they point a laser, they have a laser pointed at their eyes and sculpt their lens away so they don't need glasses. Well, now it costs you, what, $1,500? And everybody does it. So I think in the future, why not do similar things with brain enhancement technology?
When we talk about a drug or technology to restore brain plasticity, how far away do you think that kind of treatment is?
That, I think, is sort of on the 10 to 20 years horizon. Hmm. I mean, there are all sorts of other treatments. There are people now testing, better video games, for lack of a better word, that will help, for example, children with ADHD, that would help older adults to cope with cognitive decline. So they're both non-invasive things that we can do, as well as invasive technology. Invasive technologies, these are drugs that go inside our brain, or some sort of brain-machine interface that'll go inside our brain.
What's something you're working on now in Seattle at the Allen Institute for Brain Science that excites you?
What we just released last week is, for the first time ever, brain cells, the morphology, the electrical function, and the genes expressed in individual brain cells that we get from living neurosurgical tissue. So the context here is we work with local surgeons at the University of Washington Medical School and at the Swedish, and they, during the course of surgery where they need to remove a deep tissue tumor or deep tissue epileptic foci, in order to reach that foci or that tumor, they need to tunnel through the overlying cortex, the overlying bit of brain. In this case, typically it's the medial temporal gyrus. And so that piece of brain, typically that piece of brain tissue is typically discarded as medical waste. But we work with them closely, and so we can get this little piece of tissue. It's like a sugar cube, roughly, on average. It can be smaller like a pea. It can be bigger like a walnut. And then we immediately put it on life support. We put it in a special liquid, and we cool it, and we rapidly bring it over to our lab. So 20 minutes, half an hour later, it's in our lab here at the Allen Institute. And we can now poke electrode in it. We can probe. We can listen to the faint electrical signals that neurons generate. We can inject dye, and we can recover their beautiful morphology, the shape, these tendrils, their wires, the so-called axon and dendrites. We can also extract the genes that are expressed in these individual nerve cells. And all of this data we make then available, and so we released last week for the first time ever hundreds of cells that we get in this way from living human tissue. I emphasize the living tissue because almost everything we know about human nerve cells comes from dead brains, from postmortem brains. Because for obvious reasons, you don't have access to the normal human brain. We have access to animal brains, particularly the brains of mice and rats, but of course not to humans. So here's this very rare situation where, in conjunction working with the permission of the patients and the neurosurgeons, we can access and we can harvest this tissue. That's pretty cool.
So you can analyze this brain tissue. You can listen to it, as you said, in a way. And what do you think is going to be the most profound effect of that?
Ultimately, our knowledge, so I ask you, Jennifer Aniston.
Yes, right? Now, the actress.
Something immediately comes to mind.
Yes.
Right? Well, how does it happen? So early on in my career, when I was still a university professor in Southern California, I worked with neurosurgeon Itzhak Fried, and we identified individual neurons in a page in the brain of one particular patient responded selectively to images of Jennifer Aniston. Other cells responded, let's say, to Bill Clinton or when the patient thinks about Bill Clinton. So here sort of we discover they're now called Jennifer Aniston cells or concept cells, individual neurons that respond specifically to things that you're very familiar with. Mm-hmm. The president, your mom, your girlfriend, your child, and your colleague, things that you see all the time, your brain wires up particular groups of cells that uniquely respond to that. Well, that's pretty cool. So I can now, for example, imagine I can design an interface with electrodes that directly read off the activity of these cells so I can decode what you're currently thinking. And I can decode that and use that, for example, to interface with somebody else or to interface a computer monitor or to interface directly a computer.
And why would I want to, my thoughts to interface with a computer or anybody else?
Well, so for instance, there are a few patients where this is happening already now, where their thoughts, because they're unable to move, because they were in car accident or bike accident, they're quadriplegic, their intentions to move, their thoughts that I now want to move to the right, or I want to press this particular key on the piano, is decoded by a brain-machine interface, and then can decode the thought, okay, the patient now wants to push this key versus that key on a piano, and then a synthesizer pushes that key electronically. So this patient now, the one I'm thinking of, she can play piano with her mind because she can't do it with her hands anymore because of the damage to her spinal cord.
And by the way, this doesn't sound like artificial intelligence. This sounds like tapping human intelligence.
This, well, okay, but it does involve techniques for, because you need to do this decoding. You need to sort of understand the language of the neurons and decipher them and decode them into something that you can give to a computer, like turn left or turn right in your wheelchair or play this key versus that key. And so that involves decoding, which is done using artificial AI or machine learning techniques. So it does involve bits and pieces of artificial intelligence. I mean, AI has lots of benefits, even to researchers. We have these masses of data sitting in our vaults, for instance, at the Yale Institute, and we use deep machine learning technologies to help us understand all of this because it enables us to do vastly more than ever before with fewer human intervention, which is a boon for science because there's vastly more data than we can ever have people analyze.
You know, Dr. Koch, you're very forceful when you talk to a listener who doesn't know you. You might even sound frustrated. How do you feel about the future you're helping create at the Allen Institute for Brain Science?
Well, the future we create is one of trying to understand our brain. Our brains is who we are. Your memory, your thoughts, your passion, your love, your hates, your dreams, all of that arises out of the brain. And so in order to understand us, ourselves, our nature, we need to understand our brains. So this is a basic scientific quest to understand who we are. And then as always in science, the handmaiden of science is technology. Once we have that understanding, we can use that, for example, to fix broken brains. When you hear voices, when you feel paranoid, when you begin to forget things, right? Like in Alzheimer, in schizophrenia. And so we can try to help these people by rationally designing therapies. And then ultimately, if they become safe and easier to use, we can also then use our scientific knowledge to help all of us to enhance our brains. In particular, I think this will be necessary as AI becomes more and more powerful.
Finally, Dr. Koch, some of us hear about brain institutes and brain science and artificial intelligence. Some of us feel excited. Some of us feel concerned. How would you like us to think about your work?
The work is all exciting. There's no reason to be concerned about, right? We are understanding, we're trying to understand, we're still in very early days in brain science. Neuroscience is still a young discipline compared to chemistry or physics. And our goal is to understand who we are. I see nothing concerning about that. The adage of Western philosophy is know thyself.
One way the to Oracle know, at Delphi.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, one way to know ourselves is know sort of the basis of where you come from and who you are. And partly we are a product of our brains. So we should understand our brains, in particular, if we want to help people, with various pathology of the brain. But also if we want to enhance our own. So I think there's nothing to be there concerned about. AI, sort of, it's a more mixed thing. It gives us profound benefits, but there will also be challenges. Look, Ronald Reagan said this very well. The future is not for the faint of heart. The future is for the bold.
I think that oracle, besides saying know thyself, also said nothing in excess. So you're going to rein in the excesses for us, right?
Well, I mean, yes, we'll try.
That's Dr. Christoph Koch, chief scientist and president of the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle, telling you about some of the work he's doing right here in your neighborhood. This is The Record on KUOW, and we'll be back in just a moment. So you just heard the president of the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle telling you how his work might result in someone playing a piano concerto with her mind. Now let's talk about who pays for health care, high-tech and low-tech. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders wants there to be a single payer. He was just in Canada trying to figure out how that country provides universal health coverage and whether the USA can learn anything. And here to tell you more is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, Bill.
So Bernie Sanders has been calling for government health care for quite a while. Why does he need to visit Canada?
Well, he's one of the things he was doing here, apart from flattering us, which of course always makes Canadians feel good, especially when we're having all these trade disputes with the U.S. But apart from flattering us, he was also throwing out a challenge, which is how we manage to have universal health care coverage for everyone at about, well, not quite half, but close to half the cost of the U.S. So per capita, we spend less on health care and provide universal. How do we do it? And that's essentially what he threw out for discussion here. I think he was in the long distance probably talking to American audiences as much as he was to us.
Okay, so how does Canada provide universal health care at a lower cost?
Well, one of the things about universal health care is that it can be, if run properly, more efficient. You don't have a lot of duplication through the system. You don't have insurance companies battling with government, battling with employers over who pays and who pays for what. Here in British Columbia, for example, we have a centralized hospital in Vancouver for children. We have a centralized hospital in Vancouver for a burn unit. And if a British Columbian in some other part of the province needs care there, we dispatch a jet to pick them up, bring them in, or an air ambulance. It's more efficient than having a burn unit everywhere. So it's those kinds of savings that we do that certainly save some of the money. We also do one other thing. We have higher taxes. So, you know, if you want more, I guess, a more comprehensive system, you can pay higher taxes. Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't really answer the cost question. And the other thing, of course, we have, and this one Sanders didn't talk about, but most Canadians would, is we have waiting lists. So if it's emergency care or life-threatening cancer or something that's going to do you in, you go, you get the care right away in a good hospital. But if you're waiting, say, as I am, for a knee replacement, I'm probably going to wait over a year to get it. So that kind of thing saves some money in the system as well.
And that's countercultural, at least in the United States. There's seems like there's more of an anti-bureaucracy, anti-long-line attitude here. Any idea what makes our next-door neighbors so different in that regard?
I think a lot of it is the way things have grown up. I think a lot of it is law, and you're right. I think the different culture. I think Canadians, we've had a form of universal health care here since the 1960s, but we've had waiting lists for a long time as well, and we're used to them. And if you're, you know, if you really don't want to do the waiting list, some Canadians do this. They call up a health care broker. There's a business here that does that. And the broker finds an American hospital that'll do it for a fixed price, and you fly down there and you have the knee done. So you can do that. And in fact, this is odd, Bill. It probably sounds counterintuitive as well. But the fact that the American system is next to us and it has all this unused capacity is one of the ways the Canadian system runs. A certain number of Canadians go across the border and pay for MRIs, pay to jump the wait list. These are obviously well-to-do Canadians. And so we kind of survive a bit off the American system. It acts as a bit of an escape valve for our waiting lists and some of the services we don't provide.
Ah, so our system kind of enables your system. What would Canada do if Bernie Sanders got his way?
Well, the other thing that's fascinating about Sanders, and again, we didn't get into a lot of this up here, is he's proposing a system that's far more comprehensive than ours. So visits to the doctors, surgery, ongoing health care, physician services and that, and hospitals, is covered. But as I read the Sanders proposal, he's talking about vision care, pharmaceutical drugs, dentistry, all kinds of things like chiropractic and that sort of thing, so physiotherapy and that. I mean, he's talking about a system that's more universal than ours. In our system, a lot of that what we regard as sort of extraneous services or extra health care is provided, in my case, by my employer. I have a separate benefit plan with him. Other people have private plans. But not everything is covered up here, and the thing that's fascinating to me about Sanders is he's talking about more coverage than we have.
Well, more surprising political developments have come true in the USA lately, so we'll keep watching.
That's... Go on, you're kidding.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer telling you about a U.S. senator going over there and talking single-payer health care. Thanks a lot, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And thank you for listening to The Record on KUOW. Our team is Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke with a reminder about your ballot. You know, it's due Tuesday. If you're a late voter, you'll want to tune in to KUOW tomorrow at noon for the Week in Review. My guests and I will get you smart about the election and dig into more of the week's big stories, too. Have a great afternoon. BBC News is next.